Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When it comes to defining the canon of English literary greats, the Norton Anthology of English Literature is the world's big gun. Since 1962, in 8 million copies lugged across campus by generations of dutiful students, the Norton Anthology has been the who's in, who's out arbiter of what is great, what matters, what lasts. Every 6 years, the anthology is resifted, refined for a new edition. With this year's edition, there's a new top editor as well, for the first time ever, and changes. A Passage to India, out. The White Man's Burden, somehow, in. Up next on Point, passing the torch at the Norton Anthology and the ins and outs of the canon. Joining me now in the studio is Stephen Greenblatt, professor of English at Harvard University and new general editor of the Norton Anthology of English Literature. He's author of Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare, for which he was finalist for a National Book Award in 2004. Stephen Greenblatt, good to see you again.
Thanks. Nice to see you, Tom.
And with us from Ithaca, New York, is M.H. Mike Abrams, Professor Emeritus of English at Cornell, and one of the nation's most esteemed literary scholars. He was the founding general editor of the Norton Anthology of English Literature more than 40 years ago, and at age 93 has just stepped aside. Professor Abrams, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello.
I want to begin with you, Professor Abrams, if I may. When you first began this work in the 1950s, preparing, I guess, for that 1962 rollout, did you ever imagine that this would become a kind of the arbiter of the canon?
I certainly did not, nor have I ever thought of it as establishing a canon. That isn't the point, of course, of the anthology. The point is to make it as useful as possible in courses that introduce students to the greatness, the variety, and the long history of English literature. When I was asked to undertake this anthology, I thought it would take about a year to accomplish by myself and six other editors whom I selected. It actually took 4 years. I thought it would endure as a textbook with luck for a decade. Well, it's lasted much longer than that now. And while its establishment of a canon is a mistaken way to put it, for two reasons, I think. Mm. One is that that isn't the aim at all. In the second place, the choice of the items that go into the anthology is at least as much a choice made by the people who adopt it to teach their students as it is by the editors who winnow their suggestions and make the final decisions. Having said that, of course, one must admit that without intending to, it does serve for the many thousands and now millions of people who've used the anthology in college. It does serve to establish in their minds a kind of hierarchy of writers as a byproduct, not an intentional aim of the anthology.
Not that you claim it, and it's right there in the seventh edition. I'm reading in the preface that the outpouring of English literature overflows all boundaries, including the capacious boundaries of this multi-thousand-page work. So you don't claim to be the canon, and yet, if you're in or you're out, this is what's handed out to generations of students. Stephen Greenblatt, you're taking the reins here after Mike Abrams, Professor Abrams, very long and successful, 8 million copies in print. Lord knows how many classes have used it for all these years. Here you've got the epic poems and short lyrics and plays and ballads and erotic fantasies and short stories. Do you have the sense, whether you like it or not, of sort of taking the reins not just of a book, but of what future generations of English readers are going to understand as the most important things to have read in English?
I certainly have a sense of responsibility to the enormous tradition of English literature, to the genius over and over again manifested in the poems and plays, and also to this wonderful book that Mike and his fellow editors managed to create. I also have a sense of huge pleasure and humility. And I have a further sense, Tom, that the English language and English literature doesn't belong to the Norton Anthology or to the people in the Norton Anthology. It's a huge, amorphous and ongoing enterprise, and it isn't the case that anyone possesses it. It's much bigger than any book, any set of individuals, and it will continue to be bigger.
Professor Abrams, when you set out on this task, wading into, 13 centuries or more of English writing, how did you begin to decide what would be in and what would be out? I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, the sort of big pieces are easy, but this is a capacious book, as you write. You've got authors that are not at the Shakespeare level in here, and then you've got to decide what from each. By what criteria did you bring to bear?
It was grounded in a course that I taught at Cornell, Survey of English Literature, and one of the first, some of the problems you mentioned turned up in assigning the readings in that course. Whatever I and my colleague David Aitchis decided to put in the course, we also put immediately into the anthology. But as you indicate, the troublesome items are those that approach the fringe of being clearly classics that will endure and that have to be represented. We did the best we could. We appointed experts in each of the seven major periods of English literature, all of whom brought their expertise to bear, their knowledge of the literature of that period, and their sense of what is most important and most representative mm-hmm. and most needed to be included. But after the establishment of the initial edition, the process of winnowing things out, of deciding what to include, what to leave out, was left very much to the adopters of the anthology. There were hundreds of adopters immediately all over the country.
Adopters meaning teachers who picked it up and used it.
Teachers, exactly, who use it and require the students to helplessly to buy it if they're going to pass the course.
And carry it.
That's right, and carry it. That's always been a problem. But what we learned to do very quickly is when we came to the time when we thought a new edition was appropriate, we handed out a questionnaire answered by hundreds, literally hundreds, of teachers who use the anthology in their classes, who indicated by simple checks what items they actually used, mm-hmm. then by another check mark, what items they didn't use but thought should be kept, by a further check mark, what items they didn't use they thought should be deleted. And then they were asked what writers not included should be included and what works by those writers we not included we should add. So that and we took those suggestions very, very seriously. So that, in a way, you can consider the present contents of the anthology a long process of collaboration between the editors and the teachers, with the editors themselves, teachers of that course in their own university, that the anthology was oriented toward.
Perhaps one should add, Mike, that though they weren't directly polled, I won't say final, but significant arbiters of what goes in are the students and the readers. Because if the students
exactly.
don't like it, if the students go dead in a class and can't stand what they're doing, you know that the people will say, the people who've assigned the book will say next time around, I'm not going to teach this. I don't want it.
So are the contents on autopilot here, or is there still a margin of editorial discretion?
They're not on autopilot at all. There's, of course, very considerable editorial discretion and prerogative, but what we take seriously, the principle of accessibility and usefulness for these books. It matters. A book that's not read is not a useful book. A book that contains an enormous number of great works commented on very solemnly and learnedly that is not read with pleasure by anyone is useless.
Amen. We hear that. We want to enjoy the pleasure of getting inside the minds of the two of you. And there's a lot. We're going to hear some readings in this hour and also get into the discussions and debates that went into the 8th edition. For example, as I read this new table of contents, E.M. Forster, A Passage to India, is out. Rudyard Kipling, The White Man's Burden, is in. What was the thinking behind that, Mike Abrams?
Maybe.
I think it's a question better put to the editor of that 8th edition.
Well, perhaps the new editor's fingerprint is here.
My fingerprint is on this one, probably. Of course, as Tom probably knows, it's not the whole novel, A Passage to India.
Right.
Then he's taken out as a chapter of A Passage to India. And in general, I am prejudiced against the inclusion of single chapters from long novels. If we have to do it, we do it, but to give a taste of a writer's style. But novels are a problem for anthologies in general. It's very difficult. We have whole novels in the Norton Anthology, but it's, of course, they're enormously...
They're short ones, and if it's only going to be a piece, which piece?
Yes, exactly. So we did actually make a decision, of course, with the period editors that... that the chapter from Forster's marvelous novel was much less useful than this extraordinary, unsettling and upsetting poem by Kipling that was a kind of performance piece endlessly recited by people, The White Man's Burden from the late 19th century, and we put that in. It was not a direct exchange. Nothing is a direct exchange, but you're right that we took something out and put something in.
And yet at crowding 3,000 pages, something has to leave. We should give us a sense, Stephen Greenblatt, of this passing of the baton that's gone on here. You've been associated now, working on the anthology for some years already.
Yes.
But there's a generational shift here. Mike Abrams is 93 and still very much at it. But nevertheless, there's a generational shift. There's different views of the great opus of English language across so many authors. I'm curious how that shows up in the book itself.
Well, first thing to be said, Tom, is that the Norton Anthology has been changing over the years. In any case, it's not remained anything fixed. That's part of its success. It's always been open to rethinking. But, of course, it's also true that there is a generational shift, not only with my coming on board, because I'm getting long in the tooth myself, but there's a whole new generation of younger editors who have also come onto the team and joined the editors for the first time in this 8th edition who are here. And everything was on the table. We were willing to discuss everything, what we'd take out, what we'd put in. My approach to literature is different from Mike's, inevitably, but we meet on a very considerable common ground. But maybe I could give you a quick sense of how startling the changes are. If you just look at the first edition of the Norton Anthology, which was the great success in 1962, and if you look at the list of the Romantic poets in the Romantic period, which is Mike's great specialty. Mm-hmm. It goes Burns, Blake, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Byron, Keats. That's how it starts.
Okay.
And if you look at, if you give me a half a second.
we've got a lot of pages to thumb through here.
If you look at the comparable list now in the 8th edition, we go Anna Barbeau, Charlotte Smith, Mary Robinson, Blake, Burns, Mary Wollstonecraft, Joanna Bailey, Mariah Edgeworth, William Wordsworth, Dorothy Wordsworth.
Now that is fascinating.
Samuel Coleridge, and so forth. The authors whom you expect to be there are there, but it's a whole different sense, and this is not just this edition. This has been happening for
over 40 years.
There's a whole different sense of what this period is, of who the voices are from the early 19th century, whom we should actually hear, who's the power and beauty of whose speech we should listen to.
And this is just one example, but let's look at it. Professor Abrams, this is your great field. What do we make of the change in the romantics who are here? Does it mean that your own sense of them evolved over the years, that professors didn't like the same ones you liked, that we've become more nuanced? Why would that be?
Well, it reflects, of course, among other things, but primarily the enormous revolution that's taken place in the evaluation of women writers, who often in their own lifetime were regarded as important, whose books were reviewed as much as the male authors' books, but then dropped out, and so that we reflect the great shift in in the attitude toward an evaluation of women writers.
So there's a we there. There's a we there, but also an I. Does it mean, M.H. Abrams, that you were a male chauvinist in 1959 and enlightened in the 79 or whenever?
No.
The change?
It just shows you that we don't create a canon. We follow a canon we've inherited. When we started this anthology, there were very few women that were regarded as classic writers in English literature. Mm-hmm. As time went on, those women made an appearance, were evaluated, reconsidered by me as well as by our other editors, and admitted to the anthology. But I think one point needs to be made here. That the admission of women writers was not at the expense of the male writers that had been originally in the anthology.
We heard that
the first edition was relatively short compared to the current editions, and for a long time we could simply add new writers as they came over the horizon, women or men, without deleting anything to make room.
But now I think you're
as
just about at the physical bounds.
Yeah, at time, we approached the limits established by physics, that's right, the size of a book that could be carried and that wouldn't fall apart because it had too many pages. But if you look at the last edition,
yes,
despite the enormous variety of literature that's put in that wasn't in the last edition, that wasn't in the first edition,
yes,
the male writers represented in the first edition are still there and sometimes with still more space provided than they had in the first edition. So what's happened is not a displacement of male writers, of the canonical writers of the past, by the newly arrived women writers.
Yeah.
It's been a supplementation.
We've got
and
physics and sexual politics and supplementation all at work here.
Well, it's what we do is provide in this anthology a library of writers from which every teacher can select those he wants to teach and according to his own judgment, and it's just available. We make these things available. The final selection of what they're going to teach is up to each individual instructor, who, by the way, now are at least there are at least as many women teaching the course as there are men. When we started, most of the teachers of this course were male.
Stephen Greenblatt, I wish you'd begin to give us a taste of what's between the covers here. I mean, we'll look at some of what's new in and what's new out, but there's some classics that are kind of new here as well. Beowulf, I think in the 7th edition when Seamus Heaney's came in.
Yes, one of our earliest works in the anthology is the great, very early, first half of the 8th century epic poem Beowulf, which was written in Old English, Anglo-Saxon, which is no longer, even though it stands at the origin of our language, it's no longer really comprehensible if you don't take some time to study it. And we have an extraordinary translation. Let me give you a sense of what it sounds like in its original, just for a moment or two.
Yes,
and
please.
Then you'll see what Seamus Heaney won a Nobel Prize, the Irish great Irish poet who won a Nobel Prize in literature in 1995, does with it. It doesn't sound like our speech any longer. Fa se Elengast erforth leecha thraga yatholada se the in thistrumbad that he dogara yahwam dream gehirda hludna in hela.
I'm flummoxed. Bring me Seamus, quick.
Here, quick. Relief is on the way. Then a powerful demon, a prowler through the dark, nursed a hard grievance. It harrowed him to hear the din of the loud banquet every day in the hall, the harp being struck, and the clear song of a skilled poet telling the mastery of man's beginnings.
There a rare moment when English itself can be updated,
yes,
within the boundaries of the language.
So we begin with this extraordinary, magnificent poem in a remarkable contemporary translation, by the great contemporary poet Seamus Heaney. And then we go on through the whole course of English literature. And the principle fundamentally here is works that can still reach you, can still reach out and touch you. Because actually the principle of literature in general is that if it works for you at all, they're things that seem suddenly that the enormous amount of time is dropped away and something is speaking directly to you. So here's, for example, just a four-line poem from the 14th century, so written in Middle English. But here it's not in translation. This is how it goes. It's called Western Wind.
This is anonymous.
Anonymous poem from, it's like so much of the beautiful lyric poetry of the 14th century. Western wind, when wilt thou blow? The small rain down can rain. Christ, that my love were in my arms, and I in my bed again. You don't need to know an enormous amount about. It's nice to know an enormous amount about 14th century culture. You don't need to know that to begin to get what's going on here.
English haiku there, and it comes straight through.
And it's as if the centuries have dropped away, and something is speaking directly to you. And for me, at least, that is, with all the ideological differences between Mike's generation and mine, between this person and that person, that is the core here. The core is to be touched inwardly.
M.H. Abrams, it was just, 15 or 20 years ago that view was under pretty strong attack. People saying it can't just be about power and beauty. We have to understand the context and the politics of everything. And then even the view, you may remember the famous New York Times piece, 1988, where an English professor was quoted saying, you know, one piece or another, it's the difference between a hoagie and a pizza. These distinctions don't matter. Power, beauty is the wrong measure. Did you feel your boat rocked for a while by that anti-canonical movement?
Well, if it rocked, it soon steadied itself once more. It's the momentum of the traditional valuation of these poems, or rather the degree to which they continue to speak to generations, is immense, and it's very hard to change that development. The very first edition of the Norton Anthology included contextual matters, as we now refer to them. We included what we call topics in English literature to serve as a context within which to read the literature written in the time and participating in similar currents of opinion that you find in the non-literary realms. After a certain number of editions, we dropped that, only to come back to it now, especially since we have the great theorist of that contextual reading of literature, the contextual interpretation of literature, Stephen Greenblatt, taking over the helm of the Norton Anthology. But again, that is not an innovation for the anthology. It's just a development of something we included from at the very beginning.
The notes, the context of the particular time, century by century, the Victorian age, and on?
Yes, but when you regard the context of literature as all the currents of opinion in a variety of fields in which that literature partook, I think it's easy to exaggerate the change that took place when Stephen Greenblatt came aboard. He and I disagreed on very little, and our disagreements, such as they were, evaporated very quickly, because in both instances, the final criterion of a great work of literature is the power and the resonance, the reverberance of it in the reading itself. Mm. On this, we both agreed.
Mm. M.H. Abrams, Stephen Greenblatt, stand by for a moment. I want to bring another voice and perspective into our conversation. Joining us from Washington is Tayari Jones. She is a professor of English at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, teaches creative writing there. For this spring semester, she's a visiting writer at George Washington University. She's the author of The Untelling and Leaving Atlanta. Tayari Jones, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So here you are. You're writing right now. You're teaching right now. You're an African-American woman. Here's the Norton Anthology, the sort of great collection of dead white males. It was criticized for a while. How do you look at this anthology? Do you see it as the canon? Do you see it as a, you know, an invitation to dance or as a wait?
Well, you know, I approached this topic with great skepticism because my earliest notion of the Norton is when I was a student at Spelman College, a black women's college in Atlanta, And I remember our teachers supplementing the Norton Anthology with as many pages as was in the anthology itself.
Now we're getting up into many thousands, if that's the case.
Yes, and we had to read it all. And when I first tried to go to graduate school, I was rejected from a Big Ten university because the curriculum I had studied was not consistent with the Norton Anthology. This was written in my rejection letter.
So when you look at it today, do you still see it as incomplete, as a kind of a starting point that you need to supplement or that we should all supplement? How do you look at it? Do you look at it as a kind of, a gated community? Do you like the gate?
Well, I have to say that it has come a long way. I looked through the table of contents of the 8th edition, and I had to sit down. I saw Louise Bennett, the Jamaican poet who writes in Patois. I saw her there. I saw Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. I was really surprised at how inclusive. I thought, this is not the Norton Anthology that locked me out of graduate school 15 years ago.
So when you teach your English courses today, do you use it?
No, I don't. I tend to use, when I teach, I don't teach all the way, the romantics and things like that. I teach more contemporary literature, and I also tend to use the other Nortons, the Norton Anthology of African American Literature. There are all these, I almost want to call them sub-Nortons, and I say that because when I was speaking about the Norton Anthology of African American Literature, someone said, oh, I thought you meant the real Norton Anthology.
Let me ask you something, Terry Jones. You're a writer yourself and a wonderful writer. In the back of your mind, would you like to see Tari Jones one day in the Norton Anthology? Would you feel as though you had made it by some measure if that were to transpire?
Well, the thing about having the real Norton Anthology, to be in the Norton Anthology in many ways is to be made real, is to be made regular. It's like saying, welcome to the mainstream. And who wouldn't want to be included in such a prestigious anthology? But what I really want is, I really want a readership that is more inclusive. I want a readership that knows that literature is universal. And so if me being in the Norton Anthology one day means that we've achieved that goal, that's what I want. I don't want to get too hung up on symbols. Instead think about what are people reading. And I think that Americans are reading more now. Things are being thought classic even without being anointed.
Yeah, that's great. Terry Jones, you expand our perspective. We're grateful for it, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
I'd love to hear a couple of examples of something that's left in the 8th edition, something that's gone out of the Norton Anthology, and maybe a couple of things that have come in. What can you share with
us,
Stephen Greenblatt?
Well, I could have made life easy for myself by choosing something that listeners probably would have found incomprehensible or dull, but I chose something that many listeners will love that did go out, a short poem by A.E. Houseman. We have many other poems by Houseman, late 19th century writer here, but this is a poem called With Rue My Heart Is Laden. With rue my heart is laden for golden friends I had, for many a rose-lipped maiden and many a light-foot lad. By brooks too broad for leaping, the light-foot boys are laid, the rose-lipped girls are sleeping in fields where roses fade.
Too lovely? Too thin?
No, not too lovely. I mean, it's a perfectly nice poem, actually. It's a less powerful poem than many other poems by Houseman because it's a bit artificial, but it's a charming poem. It's lost, at least we thought, judging from the responses that we had from our users and also simply from the space constraints, it didn't have enough force any longer in its charm to be on the printed pages, given what else we wanted to have in the anthology.
Read something for us that's coming in with the 8th
edition. Well, here's something new to the 8th edition, a poem by Derek Walcott, a writer who teaches very close to where we are having our conversation
right
at Boston
now.
University, a Nobel Prize winner, born in Santa Lucia in the Caribbean, and dividing his time, I think, now between Trinidad and Boston University. This is a poem called The Season of Phantasmal Peace. And what it does is to imagine a moment, weird, mystical moment, in which the earth has a brief moment of peace brought about, strangely enough, by a conspiracy, as it were, of birds. I'll just read one stanza from it. Then all the nations of birds lifted together the huge net of the shadows of this earth in multitudinous dialects, twittering tongues, stitching and crossing it. They lifted up the shadows of long pines down trackless slopes, the shadows of glass-faced towers down evening streets, the shadow of a frail plant on a city sill, the net rising soundless as night, the birds' cries soundless until there was no longer dusk or season, decline or weather, only this passage of phantasmal light that not the narrowest shadow dared to sever. Mm.
Derek Walcott from the latest edition of the Norton Anthology, and we hear it's merit. Mary's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two questions. One is about hubris, and the second is about politics. Okay, do the English really pay any attention to the Norton Anthology?
You mean the English as in British English over there?
Yes, and I think the white man's burden is perfect irony, because it brings a currency to it to show people that literature is not something that you're forced to study. And will the professors be accused of being left-leaning because they have all those women and they have that poem in the Norton Anthology?
That's a lot of great questions. Let us pick them up. M.H. Abrams, first to you on the global readership here. Is this an American icon or more?
The use of anthologies in literature courses and other courses was much more, much stronger in America than in Britain. But gradually, the British have come over and have seen that buying an anthology like the Norton gives them, for a relatively small sum, a collection of writings that otherwise would require buying literally hundreds of separate volumes. So they now buy the Norton literature, sign it in large quantities. Norton has an office in London. But also, the thing has made its way around the world, and there isn't a high-level, highly cultured country anywhere in any part of the world that doesn't buy large quantities of the anthology. I'm simply overwhelmed sometimes to find that somebody comes from a distant part of Africa and has been made familiar with the anthology.
We won't solve Mary's hubris question, but you know, before we go, M.H. Abrams, you've edited this for so long, I'd love to have you read something for us. Whatever you'd like from the heart of this anthology that was in your hands for more than four decades, what would you leave us with?
Well, I could read any one of thousands of poems and say that it is a safe bet these poems will endure as long as the language endures and will have a place in the anthology, no matter what else goes. Let me read just a short poem by Keats, because I find myself, as I get older, reading Keats oftener than when I was younger, partly because Keats was such a young poet with such a fresh voice. This is a poem called La Belle Dame sans Merci. It's grounded in the very ancient legend of a human man who's destroyed by falling in love with a lady from fairyland. It's modeled on the folk ballad, but Keats makes the four-line stanza of the ballad magical by curtailing the fourth line in every stanza from four stresses to two or three stresses. That establishes a hiatus in the reading that just evokes a sense of magic, of supernatural in the poem.
Please read.
I'll read it. La Belle Dame sans Merci. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge has withered from the lake, and no birds sing. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, so haggard and so woebegone? The squirrel's granary is full, and the harvest's done. I see a lily on thy brow with anguish moist and fever dew, and on thy cheeks a fading rose fast withereth too. Now comes the response at the dialogue. I met a lady in the meads, full beautiful, a fairy child. Her hair was long, her foot was light, and her eyes were wild. I made a garland for her head and bracelets too, and fragrant sown. She looked at me, she did love, and made sweet moan. I set her on my pacing steed, and nothing else saw all day long, for sidelong would she bend and sing a fairy song. She found me roots of relish sweet, and honey wild, and manna dew, and sure in language strange she said, I love thee true. She took me to her elfin grot, and there she wept and sighed full sore, and there I shut her wild, wild eyes with kisses four. And there she lulled me asleep, and there I dreamed, ah, woe betide, the latest dream I ever dreamed on the cold hill's side. I saw pale kings and princes too, pale warriors, death-pale were they all. They cried, La Belle Dame Saint Merci hath thee in thrall. I saw their starved lips in the gloam with horrid warning gaped wide, and I awoke and found me here on the cold hill's side. And this is why I sojourn here alone and palely loitering, though the sedge has withered from the lake and no birds sing. I think it's safe to say that poem will be included as long as the anthology endures, and for thousands of years after that, so long as the language endures.
We will take that as a beautiful send-off. If we had but world enough in time, we'd hear more and read more, but we're very grateful to both of you. M.H. Abrams, for all your years putting this out, many thanks to you, and thank you for being with us today.
It was a pleasure.
M.H. Abrams, the outgoing general editor of the Norton Anthology, and the new man, Stephen Greenblatt, professor of English at Harvard, author of Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. Stephen Greenblatt, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Many thanks to you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.